This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. This fall, NASA announced the space probe Voyager 1 has become the first man-made object to enter interstellar space. Essentially, that is the farthest thing we've ever sent anywhere. But as the field of space exploration expands, many people on Earth are being left behind. Very few people of color are in careers related to space travel. And this isn't just physics and mathematics, but also artists and authors who talk about space. This week, Duke University is hosting the first conference of its kind, Race in Space. The gathering brings together scientists, artists, and astronauts to talk about the links between race and space travel. Three of the conference participants join us now. Rhonda Sharp is a mathematician. She is also a visiting professor of African and African American Studies at Duke and part of their research network on racial and ethnic inequality. Rhonda, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us is Yatasha Womack, author of Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture. Yatasha, welcome.
Thank you.
Jarita Holbrook is with us. She is an astrophysicist, science fiction writer, and filmmaker. Hello, Jarita.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Rhonda, let me start with you. Tell us about this conference, Race in Space. What is it?
Well, first of all, Mae Jemison has this project about 100 years and being in space, right? So Starship 100. And so we're thinking about the thought that you have the humanities, so your writers and your artists, who've actually been challenging us a long time ago to actually thinking about space exploration, and then thinking about the concepts in their writings and the challenges within STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. How do you get folks to come together and have a conversation so that this is more of a reality, so that there's a generation of young folks who see this as a possibility and will begin to think more about careers in STEM so that they can participate and this race in space becomes a reality.
Start there. Tell us about STEM and the figures, sort of the disparities that we see in STEM education.
Well, I think there's two ways to actually think about STEM. So those of us in the social sciences are pushing folks to think about STEM more broadly. But traditionally, people think about STEM as science, and those are going to be your physical and natural sciences, and then engineering, so everything from civil to mechanical to electrical engineering, and then your technologies, and then mathematics and computer science. And so, you know, one of the challenges is when people think about diversity in STEM fields and recruiting more minority folks, you don't really have a sense of the numbers. And so if we think about engineering at the doctorate level, which are generally going to be the scientists who are doing the innovations to actually get us to space exploration, 4% of those are Black. 5% of the degrees went to Hispanics and roughly 27% to minorities. The lion's share of the degrees are going to white males.
Jarita, you are an astrophysicist. You're one of that 5% or 4% who got the degree.
Less. The numbers are much more dismal in astrophysics. In astrophysics, they grant about 150 PhDs a year, of which we're lucky if one is African-American or Black. And usually it's zero is Native American, and maybe one is Hispanic. And then there's actually an underrepresented Asian Americans in astronomy as well. So it's just not very well diverse in astrophysics.
What do you think is happening?
There's lots of theories as to why, in particular, astronomy is bad. It has to do with it's a gentleman's profession and it's a wealthy profession. There's a lot of things that happen within astronomy and astrophysics which drive minorities away. One of the theories that I've been looking at, which I've developed myself, is competing forms of masculinity. So most American men have an idea of what it means to be a man. And when you look at astrophysicist men, they're not exhibiting a lot of those qualities. And so they don't see themselves as wanting to be like the men that are in astrophysics.
So I guess when it comes to space travel, rocket envy is a big problem, then, you're saying. Well, forgive me, but that does sound like a party. Well, Yatasha, you are speaking at this conference more about the role of imagination in space travel. Tell us about that.
Sure. I recently wrote a book called Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture, and it looks at looking at the parallels between the imagination, technology, Black culture, and liberation, really to expand this idea of transcending race, transcending boundaries. And one of the primary ways of exploring this, particularly when you look at science fiction, is to create more images of people of color in space in the world of science fiction, just as a visual. Oddly enough, in many books and in films that explore science fiction, the world isn't a very diverse one until somewhat fairly recently, and even then, not so much so. So one of the challenges or opportunities that many artists have today is to be able to create these images, whether it's through film or the visual arts or literature, and really inspire the imagination so that young kids or people in general can see themselves in the future, can see themselves involved in space travel, but also to kind of break a lot of limitations and barriers around the possibilities of what can be.
Certainly.
And to view yourself as a change agent.
Yeah, I guess when you think of those, when science fiction really exploded in film on the scene in the 1950s, it was mostly Peter Graves saving the world, right? I mean, this white guy. And so, those are the pictures we have. And all the scientists had German accents. So there's a lot of stereotyping, I guess, that goes on and probably still does in the imagery around space travel, the imagination. So, Jarita, let me ask you the question. How did you do it? I mean, were you were looking at a landscape where there weren't many people who looked like you, right, in the...
It's interesting because I'm from Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is quite diverse. And when I was going through school, I wasn't the only person who wanted to be an astrophysicist. So I had a support group. It was not a strange profession to want to be an astrophysicist. And it only became stranger the higher I got up in the ranks. Mm.
So,
and when I was finally a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz, I was the only one who had to carry cards saying that I was a student of astrophysics because nobody actually believed me.
Well, Rhonda, you said as a mathematician that you sometimes face this same kind of skepticism when you walk through the halls of the Academy as well.
Yeah, as we were chatting, I think it's unclear for me how much is it about my gender and about my youth in terms of being a faculty member. I was fortunate enough that my first advanced degree in mathematics was at Clark Atlanta University, and that's a historically black college. So I was in an environment where my blackness wasn't odd. In fact, I tell people I've been brainwashed twice. First at Clark is where I heard I had to get a PhD in mathematics because there were so few black mathematicians. And then second when I got to Stanford. But I think what I ran into was getting to Stanford and being in the School of Engineering, doing OR as a master's. And it was the first time that I had heard that as a black female, I should not be doing math and should not be doing engineering, that somehow there was something odd and rare about me.
So the normalization of this is really key. We can do it through the imagination and through the study of the hard sciences. Rhonda Sharp, mathematician, visiting professor of African and African-American studies at Duke, part of the Research Network on Racial and Ethnic Inequality. Yatasha Womack, author of Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture. Jarita Holbrook is an astrophysicist, science fiction writer, and filmmaker. And our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking about Duke University's upcoming conference, Race in Space. Rhonda Sharp is a mathematician and a visiting professor of African and African-American studies at Duke. She's part of their research network on racial and ethnic inequality. Yatasha Womack is the author of Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture. And Jarita Holbrook is an astrophysicist, science fiction writer, and a filmmaker. And they're all part of Duke's Race in Space Conference that takes place October 25th. And 26th. So, Jarita, you know, you were talking about the kind of the role of masculine imagery, the masculine role in astrophysics. Do you think that also plays a factor in the other sciences, or is that particular to astrophysics?
I think it's particular to the sciences that have a shortage of women, that it's kind of a loop that happens. You have this hyper-masculine culture, which borders on rudeness, and then you wonder why women don't want to stay in those fields because they're being treated rudely. So I think it's a factor in one of the contributing factors as to why certain branches of physical science are not as well populated by women as other branches.
Rhonda, are there other, what are some of the other factors that play into this? Because what we're seeing to some extent is that STEM works pretty well, and maybe it doesn't, but in terms of representation, not bad K through 12, and then things start to drop off, undergrad, and then when we get into graduate programs, that's when things really change. Am I right about that?
I think people would say to you that the problems probably start 9 through 12. The representation at the undergraduate level isn't great, but it's better than at the PhD. When we are talking to young folks about doing the PhD, the first thing that generally comes to mind is the time. So you're thinking minimum 3 years if you're super good. If you're in the sciences with labs, you can be talking 6-7 years. And that's difficult for a lot of young folks to think about in terms of foregone wages. So what ends up happening at the undergraduate level is you get recruited to corporate America. You come in and you're diversity for them. And then often what will happen is these folks will get on the MBA track. And the MBA is 2 years and it's different money. So I think it's, you know, the competition for the skill set that corporate America is competing as you're trying to get folks to think about longer term, the contribution. And I think, again, going back to what Yatasha is saying, getting people to think about seeing themselves in that space. And I think it's also prudent for those of us who are faculty to rethink how we sell the academy, right? And so I like to think about it as a way to be an entrepreneur, because once you have a PhD, you are considered an expert in the discipline, which means other people will pay you for your opinion, and they'll pay you pretty well for that. But we don't generally sell that as a selling point. You've got to get them to be willing to commit the time.
And
you
have to wait and turn down other offers in between, as you suggested earlier. So let's talk then about the role of popular culture in all of this in creating this kind of normal vision of everybody participating. Yatasha, tell us about Afrofuturism and today's popular culture.
Well, Afrofuturism has existed for a very long time in terms of people of color, of African descent, working with sci-fi models to tell stories. W.E.B. Du Bois actually wrote a science fiction story, which many people don't know. And there were many activist advocates, particularly in the late 19th century, who were black in the United States, who explored speculative fiction in addition to some of their advocacy work, which I think is really, really intriguing. But Afrofuturism as a term was really cultivated in the 90s. It was a phrase coined by Mark Derry, and it took a look at popular culture, particularly funk music. It looked at George Clinton and some of his sci-fi metaphors. It looked at Sun Ra, who was an avant-garde jazz artist who believed that music could heal, and came up with the mythology of him coming from another planet. And it also looked at Octavia Butler as kind of the ground floor of some of these ideas. But then there's also the concept of alienation and many of the popular science fiction movies that established the genre, really taking a look at this idea of otherness, and that idea of otherness really playing into racial disparities or being very much a reflection of that. So there would be comparisons between, say, the transatlantic slave trade and alien abduction, or this idea of looking at race as a technology, which is a little different from how science fiction in general views technology. But in Afrofuturism, race itself is a technology because it was something that was created, a system that was created. And there are visionaries and people who looked at, well, how can you dismantle those power imbalances in this idea? So that's the philosophical aspect behind Afrofuturism that is being taught in schools as a way of looking at, say, critical race theory. But as far as the creative end, it's a great kind of platform to be able to do a lot of storytelling where you're talking about the future, but you're pulling from these narratives in the ancient past, whether it's mythology from the African continent or Black American pop culture, and creating sort of these new stories that really kind of free the imagination. So whether you're talking about future worlds or in some cases talking about the very distant past, there's this the idea that you can create your own story and create your own narrative, and in so doing, create new images. And I think it's really exciting today because with the technology and social media, many people who were working with these ideas can now connect with their audiences through some of these technologies.
Well, Jerita, tell us a little bit about, talk about space colonization, because that relates to colonialism on Earth in our past and present. So that's a theme that shows up often in sci-fi, but I think also relates to this topic.
Yes, it does. And it really, when you have a body of work that particularly is a metaphor for the way racism plays out in the United States, and when it's converted into film and it becomes something completely different, I feel like an opportunity is always lost. But those themes still are present in a lot of these science fiction films that end up being made, this idea of alienation, who has the right to go into space. It's the same issues that we're dealing with in diversity in STEM, who has the right to create knowledge and who is going to be relegated to just consumers of knowledge, and how is that being a practice of exclusion? So when you go into space, it's the same sorts of things. What kind of jobs are people of color allowed to have in the space race? And it's almost like there's a middle emptiness. You have your astronauts. You know, it's pretty good representation of African-American astronauts in the United States. And then, but at every level, in between the astronaut and the people who design, you have almost no people. Right. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done in populating every level.
And you say this actually plays out, too, and just spatially in the way we place our space observatories, for instance.
Yes, exactly. So we all our famous and functioning observatories in the United States are sitting on Native American land. And there's usually some conflict going on between the First Nation people and the observatory, because the observatory itself is a technopole. It's got the highest tech this and that, but there's requirements for keeping it state of the art, and that is that it has to keep the skies dark. And that means that the population around the observatory has to either follow regulations or be suppressed. So you have in the situation, I lived in Tucson for many years, you have the Tohono O'odham reservation and Kitt Peak Observatory, and from the main town on the reservation, you see the observatory. It's white domes on the top of the range in which their sacred mountain is. So you turn slightly to the right, and there's their sacred mountain, slightly to the left, and there's the observatory. And it depends. It's not rocket science. The relations are dependent upon how many Tohono O'odham people are actually employed at the observatory. But at the same time, the people, the Tohono O'odham people, do not have a sense of ownership of that observatory, even though it's been sitting on their land for over 50 years.
You know, I wonder, Yatasha, we're talking about these kinds of direct influences, how we imagine space exploration, who we see participating in these programs, and these are direct ways. But getting back to Afrofuturism and some of the pop culture ways that we can, ways within pop culture, you know, Erykah Badu and Janelle Monáe, it seems to me, represent this in a way that isn't so directly sort of on the nose, but another way of imagining. Talk about that and their impact on all of this.
Sure. Janelle Monáe is really interesting because she uses this idea of the android. One of her alter egos is actually an android, and she plays up this imagery in a lot of her music videos. And the android is the other. So whereas in other space or other science fiction narratives, they focus on the alien, she takes the android and makes them the other. And very much uses that imagery, but plays out these storylines that are kind of this futuristic take on love and how can someone fit into society through this mode of looking at the android. But at the same time, she also talks about pushing beyond your own boundaries just in your present-day experience. You know, how can I be more of myself? How can I explore my own imagination, and why am I so heavily criticized when I look differently? I think it's also particularly interesting. because time travel is this big metaphor in science fiction, but particularly Afrofuturism, and it's used as a device for empowerment. So in Janelle Monáe's case, she pulls on a lot of imagery that spans the Black cultural landscape. She might pull from a pompadour in the 50s. She may have some bebop sounds in jazz. She may have some imagery from the 60s, or and then do some kind of space opera visualization, as well as pulling from funk music. And so it's a total assault of the senses, but pulling from all of these different narratives to create a different presence. And I think really make people think more about who are they in their given landscape. So you can say, well, what does that have to do with space travel per se? I think more than anything, if you're able to get people to look at their world a little differently, then they're able to step outside of their box and push for things that maybe they didn't always associate themselves with. Space in the future in particular. There's a course here at Columbia College that Dee Deninge Akpem teaches, and she talks about Afrofuturism in the perspective of liberation. And I think she does that because for people who have been, say, had limited access to resources historically through law and other means, to be able to imagine something is very powerful. To imagine something beyond your circumstances is sometimes can seem like an impossibility. So you can even look at someone like a Martin Luther King in terms of being an Afrofuturist, because he held on to a vision that was beyond his, that was beyond where the society was at the time. And so holding on to that vision was able to galvanize and in many ways dismantle this technology called race.
Yeah, it seems to me it works two ways. As you said, this is has an impact on me as I imagine myself in a role that I hadn't done previously. But also a lot of the art and the pop culture references show us that, in fact, we have been involved in this. We have had a role in this the whole time. We just didn't think about it that way because the storytellers were telling the story in a way that didn't include many, many, many of the contributions that we have indeed made. And so that informs the larger culture, right, the dominant culture, about a role that they hadn't seen before. So I wonder, Rhonda, what impact this will have. What are the benefits of involving more people of color in the space program and in the sciences?
I think both Yatasha and Jarita have picked up on it by bringing in the diversity. So if you think about one of the ways that we sort of think about things. So when women are involved in, let's say, a light bulb, you might think about we're more concerned about how the light she is trueness for our makeup. Now, that might sound trivial to someone, but the colors then expand to how colors look in real life. If you go back to what Yatasha said about a population of folks who have had limited resources, you become incredibly innovative about how you use stuff. I think in both instances, the diversity means that people think about their circumstances and think about ways that you can alter that. And then you begin to think about how is that transferable to other uses. So as we're thinking about space travel, there may be lots of folks who do mechanical engineering in particular design, and they are focused on the design of automobiles. They may not have thought about taking those same skills and thinking about spacecraft. So I think in many instances, by having that diversity and taking people in their circumstances and how they think about what's going on, and many of us are driven to go into science because we see a problem in our neighborhood and we want to solve that. But we don't necessarily think about, as you're saying, stepping outside of the box, as Natasha has already alluded to or mentioned, you don't think about transferring that to another realm. And I think that's what the diversity brings when you open it up and you make sure that it's inclusive.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Rhonda Sharp is a mathematician. She is also a visiting professor of African and African American Studies at Duke and part of their research network on racial and ethnic inequality. Yatasha Womack is the author of Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture. Jarita Holbrook is an astrophysicist, a science fiction writer, and a filmmaker, and they are part of Duke's Race in Space conference that takes place on October 25th. And 26th, you can find out more information about the conference at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up next, we talk with North Carolina author Lucy Daniels about her latest book, Walking with Moonshine.